Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, education and the teachers' unions. And Richard, as you and I are recording this, we've just come to the conclusion of a strike in the Los Angeles Unified School District, second largest in the country, ran for a little over a week and concluded with teachers getting a pay increase, getting reductions in class sizes, and getting some staffing promises, a nurse on every campus, librarians on all the middle school and high school campuses. And there's some other provisions too that we can talk about in a moment. But why don't we just start here with the legal framework? These are public employees charged with providing an education to kids in Los Angeles. Those kids now have lost about a week's worth of education. Looks like you've got similar strikes coming in Denver and Oakland and Virginia. So considering all this, what are the legal parameters around public employees walking off the job because they're unhappy with the terms of the labor agreements?
Well, a lot of this stuff is going to depend on state to state, and I'm not an expert on California law, but in most states, essentially the argument is if you're engaged in a service industry where it turns out a walk-off has the result of immediate losses and dislocations to students, to their families, and so forth, you ban the state, you ban the strike, and you impose compulsory arbitration. But this presupposes you have to have somebody in the state after the arbitration is done in one form or another, or the mediation is done, who's prepared to enforce that law, preferably with criminal sanctions, and essentially it doesn't happen. So what you do is you have unrestrained monopoly power, which is held by the teachers' union. What makes it even more complicated in California is they have this very strange system of funding. It is quite clear that the deficits that are going to be run up by the particular concessions that are made are going to be pretty heavy, and large fractions of them are going to fall on the state rather than falling on the city proper. And the moment you could externalize the cost of settlement, you hope, then in effect there's a strong incentive on the part of the local citizens to support something, because there's nothing wrong with a strike as far as they're concerned that brings in revenues from Sacramento. And indeed, the whole thing about this bill, which is completely iffy, is that the revenue sources for the commitments are not guaranteed, even though the commitments themselves are guaranteed. This is an old strategy which has taken place in California. The same thing took place when they reformed their pension laws to increase the size of the pensions, and they did not essentially make the pensioners take the risk that the funds wouldn't be sufficient to support it, and they've created chronic deficits ever since then. So this is going to create a lot of instability, and when you get to the state level, the politics are going to be reversed. There are going to be a large number of people in California who said, why should we bail out Los Angeles? So I think, in effect, that this is simply act one of a situation, and if they cannot make good on the funding, there are going to be massive dislocations that are going to take place down the road.
So in addition to these concerns about the price tag for the settlement, there are a set of pre-existing concerns about price tags in LA Unified, because it has seen its health care and its pension costs for employees growing at the same time that its enrollment has actually been dropping. Can you give us a sense of how these benefits for public employees shape or constrain government spending, especially in a state like California where the bill is really quite high?
Well, what happens is once these things become fixed obligations, you can no longer invest in equities. You typically have to back it with debt-denominated securities, which lowers the rate of return. California, like many other places, has always assumed a rate of return coming out of its investment funds, which exceed that actually observed in the market. And so for many years, they were up at 7 and 8%, when in fact the returns that you had were much lower, particularly on the debt side of the market. And so what you do is you're building in a structural deficit the moment you switch the money out of equities and put it into debt, and you're taking a lot of risk the moment you leave the money as an equity instead of putting it into debt. So these things are chronically underfunded, and the only solution to it is either to cut back on the benefit side of the thing or to raise the taxes. Trying to cut back on the benefit side of any pension program in California is a heroic venture. I worked on a case involving the San Jose pension funds, and these things were seriously underfunded. They ran through a public referendum referendum, which got huge support, which essentially said we're going to have to cut back pensions for existing people in order to make sure that the numbers work out. We'll give you a choice of either making larger amounts of contributions for the same benefits, or keeping your contribution level constant and lowering the benefit you receive. It had pretty solid support, and it was struck down by a state district court judge who said, if you look at California law, a key case called Kern from about 1945, is once somebody is appointed to the state and has employment, their pension rests. Benefits are fully vested. The typical corporate area is you're vested at the time of retirement. The tricky case is and always will be somebody gets fired 2 days before he's vesting. Is that regarded as a contemptible strategic maneuver or the mere exercise of a contract right? But the current situation is completely unsustainable in my view, and yet it has been sustained time and time again. And as I said before, one of the reasons why the teachers won this strike is that you have a very large liberal community in Southern California and Los Angeles, a huge number of minority students in the school district who will support this. And so even if they wanted to resist this, the popular sentiment was on the other side. The mayor, Garcetti, I gather is his name, came out fairly strongly in favor of the teachers under these circumstances. And so the school board, which was charter-oriented and financially concerned, essentially had to capitulate under these circumstances. But this thing is not over. It's a short-term victory. We don't know what the next act will be. If California suffers another kind of downturn, then it's going to have to put a larger tax burden on a smaller income base, and that could prove to be disastrous. If we could keep the thing moving up in the stock market, then they may be able to escape by the skin of their teeth. Which way is the market going to go? Well, tell me what happens in China, and I will tell you something about what's likely to happen in Los Angeles.
One of the flashpoints for the teachers in LA was the increasing presence of charter schools in California. And the teachers did not really win any substantive concessions on that. They got some rhetorical ones. But what the unions would really like to see is a cap on the number of charter schools in the state, particularly because they allege that the charters bleed students and resources from traditional public schools. Help us think about how we should parse claims like that.
Well, I mean, there's a nice column this morning by Jason Riley in the Wall Street Journal. And the first thing you notice, he says, suppose you're going on strike against an automobile company. How many of you say that you're going on strike in order to benefit the customers who are going to have to pay higher prices for their vehicles? Not many. But whenever you're dealing with these kinds of situations, the teachers will always go out and say, we're doing this for the benefit of students by trying to increase our wages. If you really cared about students, you would be talking about pay cuts, not pay increases for the same work. They want to get them more services. That helps the students, but it also increases union membership with respect to these jobs. And so they're in favor of that. The conflict, I think, is very, very acute between the teachers and the students under these circumstances. And then you get to the charter schools, and they are competitors. And in most businesses, what happens is what you do is you improve the quality of services that you give to your customers because you know that there's a risk that they're going to be taken away by somebody who supplies better situations. So you can't be a General Motors dealership or manufacturer and say, you know, all these foreign companies are coming in. If they take away our best companies, customers, we won't be able to work. You want to keep those customers, you make product and price adjustments in order to do so. They don't want to do that in the Los Angeles School District because if they didn't get some of these kinds of protections, what would happen is the demands that they're making on work rules and everything else would essentially price them out of the market. It is unambiguous today that virtually everywhere you look, the good charter schools, that is the ones that tend to grow, tend to outperform often quite dramatically the public schools. And so what the teachers unions want to do, Wendy Weingarten wants to do, is to shut off the competition by capping. If you gave it to the unions, they would like to have that cap at zero so that they would have a complete monopoly. They know they can't get that. Right now in California, you're allowed to increase the number of charter schools by 100 a year, which is a pretty liberal number. If you probably did this under market test and there was no uncertainty as to whether you could keep your charter and so forth, the number might well be 500. And so what they're trying to do is to stop this, to prevent the flow. It's not going to work. People will still do charter schools. Some will move out of the district. Some will go into homeschooling. Some will go into parochial schools of one sort or another. So keeping the dam up is going to be very tricky. And they also, they can't do it because it's not within the power of the Los Angeles Unified School District to give them this benefit. So you got to get one of these vague political promises that you're going to urge the legislature to do this. In many places, you say, oh, my God, well, that doesn't have a chance of passing. But this is California, has a very liberal legislature up and down the line. The ban on charter schools does not impose financial obligations on people who live in Sacramento. And it may well be that they get it. And who's going to lose? It's going to be all the students who can't migrate out from this particular system. I think, in effect, that the only way that you can make a system of public education work is to subject it to competition from private education. And what the teachers will have to do is lower the wages they receive and improve their services because they're going to face the conditions of a competitive market. What they say is you're going to destroy neighborhood schools. And what I'm going to say in reply, most of these things deserve to go into extinction. Even if you gave them more money, they're not going to do any kind of serious improvements unless the competition turns out to be there. So this is essentially the question of whether or not a planned economy can outperform a competitive economy. I think the answer to that question has been clear from the beginning of time. It never does. The teachers' unions think you could suspend the laws of competition and the laws of gravity and make all this thing work. The long-term implication is that the people in the city of Los Angeles who best need the education, the ones who could profit most from it, are going to be cut off from a key source in dealing with all of this situation. So I think, in effect, it's a kind of another version of the progressive tragedy that takes place in market after market, state after state, and California, unfortunately, is in the lead in this particular progression.
Another concern that we saw from these teachers, and it's a perennial of these debates, is that they felt they were required to dedicate too many resources towards testing. And the argument goes that the education reform community is obsessed with accountability to the detriment of other factors, and that we have skewed the system so much towards keeping test scores up that we're actually sacrificing a lot of the other values that an education system should be importing. Do you have any sympathy for that critique?
Well, I have some sympathy for it. I will give you my example debating to Great Neck North Senior High School back in 1959. What happened is that the New York State Board of Regents gave a series of tests, and they were perfectly sensible tests. And any one of the kids in a very gifted high school like Great Neck could go in there and get an 85 or a 90 taking the test cold. But somehow or other, because we had this test for the last 6 weeks of every term, all of a sudden we were studying for the regents, and it was a classic bore. And I thought they should have never done this, and they should have taken the risk that maybe our scores down 1% in order to give us a better education. But many of the schools that you're talking about here, the performances are actually grim. You're not talking about these very gifted kids at Great Neck North Senior High School. And if you don't test, you have no idea if what you're doing is any good or any bad. And since these people or these kids are often at the edge, making them study for the test actually will improve their ability. You're not holding back gifted students who are going to Ivy Leagues by giving them dumb tests. You're trying to get these kids together so they could balance a checkbook, get a job, go to a junior college, maybe to a regular college. The point about this is we're not trying to get people who have real disadvantages and put them into the elites. We're trying to make sure that they're stable, trustworthy, and able and self-sufficient citizens, and these tests tend to help that. So the accountability is there. The second point is you look at the charter schools. I mean, my son Elliot was in the Success Academy schools working there for many years. And what you saw is they studied to the test. But you know what? They had plays. They had sports teams. They had all sorts of extracurricular activities. What they did is they had a longer day and a more focused curriculum, and they knew what they were doing. And it turns out that the public schools can't match that, particularly on the longer day side, because they can't get the teachers the pay or the willingness to start to do this. The secret that the charter school have is vastly greater flexibility in the way in which they organize their curriculum because they don't have union work rules. If somebody tells you that you can't do both, what I suggest you do is to get on the page all of the work rules which tell what teachers can and cannot do for every one of the hours of the day and realize what happens from that particular loss of flexibility. I regard the loss of flexibility in the way in which you manage an institution as being every bit as important as the salary implications on it. So in these particular cases, I think what they really want to do is to kill the messenger, because when the news comes out how badly they perform relative to the competition, they don't have within their framework a way to change it. So what you have to do is to start to suppress it. And, you know, there are ways to do this. Okay, don't want to test everybody. Every year we test 25% of the students and let the others do something. And then we do a little natural experiment. We see whether the kids that tested do better than the ones who aren't tested. And we see whether or not the kids who were tested do better than the kids in SCARTA school who are tested and so forth. They don't want anything like that. They don't want to get more information. They just want to shut this thing down, because the less information they have, the more the rhetoric about how we're always working for the benefit of the community can go unchallenged by hard data. And I frankly think that that is not an intellectually or politically respectable position.
It's striking when you see the teachers taking to the street in Los Angeles that it is hard to think of a contemporary analog with private sector labor. Well, you one thinks back, for instance, to the late 19th or early 20th century when you had really severe and sometimes violent strikes from private sector workers. And then you contrast it to today, when if you're seeing a mass strike publicized on television, it is almost always a public sector union. So, Richard, what's behind the contrast? Why do private sector unions today seem like such a spent force compared to their public sector equivalents?
Well, public unions are trying to get public monopolies. And when there's monopoly, they're monopoly rents. And when they're monopoly rents, there's something that you can take from the other guy without losing your position. There is no viable way that you can say that if the Los Angeles Unified School District fails, some other school district is going to take up in Los Angeles. You're a private firm. And you're in the auto industry. And it turns out you've seen what happened to General Motors as it went from 500,000 workers in 1979 to 41,000 workers in 2008 when it went into bankruptcy. And you realize that you will take a strike, because if you don't take a strike, you're surely going to be bankrupt. The workers understand all of this. And so now, in order to get them to go out, what you have to do is to say, we're going to make so much money in the short run from bankrupting these guys that it's okay if you go out of business and have to get new jobs afterwards. That doesn't work anymore. And so given the fact that all industrial workers face local and indeed in many cases national or even global competition, there are no rents to extract, so they don't play that game. To give you an idea of how this works, there is a rule in standard labor law which says you are never allowed to threaten that you are going to shut down if a place is unionized. But it is perfectly permissible to give predictions as to what will happen, and more importantly, to tell what happened to places that did get unionized. So you say, look, we're in the ball bearing business, and there was Jones, and they were across the river in Ohio, and they got unionized, and 2 years later, they were bankrupt. You draw your own conclusions. And enough of that happens that unions have now realized they can't do this, which explains why the United Auto Workers cannot unionize anybody in Tennessee. They understand perfectly well they could get a premium wage. They understand perfectly well that Mississippi is next door and they're going to lose all of their positions. And that's why, instead of strengthening the union position in key states like Wisconsin and Michigan and so forth, what you do is you see right-to-work laws passed. So the competitive nature of the private market has stopped this. And in the olden days when they ran those mass strikes, you just look at what went on. A Coronado Coal case, the way we stopped the company from competing in the market is we shut down its landing port so cars and trucks cannot come and take the coal to market. When you can do that, you'll have a private strike that works. But the moment you stop private violence, as was done by the time you got normalized after the 1950s and 60s, then it's just a matter of time before unions start to decline. So in order for them to succeed, they have to do two things in the private sector. They have to get high protective tariffs, and they have to have powerful zoning laws, depending on the nature of the business that they're involved in. And interestingly enough, those two things are harder and harder to come by today than they used to be.
So final question, if you're a policymaker, and let's stay at the state level because the feds still play a relatively modest role in education, all things considered, what's the single most important thing you can do to improve education policy? If you can only file one bill as a state legislator to make education policy better, what should a lawmaker be looking at?
They should be looking at the unlimited license of charters as competitors and to say that the public unions can't stop them. Because the other thing that I would like to do, and I do believe this, is that you make it illegal to form public unions. That's not going to happen, but that was the position for a very long time in the United States. Before 1960, it was universal practice.
All right. You've been listening to The Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.